Is our food booby-trapped?
The food is booby-trapped. 80% of the 600,000 items in a supermarket have added sugar in them. I mean, that's really shocking. And the thing about it is, too, you can't just look at the label and see sugar, because they don't just list it as sugar. There's 56 names for sugar.
That's Lori David. The producer of An Inconvenient Truth is back with another groundbreaking film, this time about our toxic industrial food system. It's called Fed Up, and it's out with a companion cookbook, The Family Cooks. And vegans beware. Nina Plank says grass-fed meat and dairy are good for you.
The Real Food Cookbook represents the real food primer that I wish I'd had when I was a vegetarian facing all these beautiful foods at my farmer's markets. I just didn't know how to cook meatloaf or steak or lamb or spaghetti bolognese. I was pretty handy with vegetables, but I also wanted to learn what fats go with what and how to treat them and how to buy them. And I assembled all this information myself over many years.
Plank's new book is The Real Food Cookbook. Don't worry, she loves organic veggies too. Thanks for joining us this hour in Writer's Voice. Today's show is all about food. Stick around. Lori David revolutionized the public conversation around global warming with her film An Inconvenient Truth. Now she wants to do the same thing for our industrial food system. Her new movie, co-produced with Katie Couric, is Fed Up. It was released along with a companion cookbook filled with healthy recipes and loads of great information. David says the American public has been sold a bill of goods about what's making us fat. It's not our couch potato lifestyle or even our consumption of fatty foods. It's sugar, especially in the processed products pushed by the food industry. 80% of processed foods have added sugar, although you may not realize it because it can go under a multitude of names. And processed foods have a lot of it. Take your so-called healthy yogurt. I can't even find a plain yogurt in my local supermarket. It's all flavored and loaded up with 18 grams or more of sugar. That's more than 4 teaspoons per cup. Sugar, along with white bread, rice, and other high glycemic foods, overwhelm the body's ability to properly digest glucose. That means it's converted more readily to the most dangerous kind of fat, like that stuff around our middles, rather than to muscle and bone. And it's not just making us fat, it's making us sick. The experts Fed Up interviewed said added sugar is a major cause of diabetes and is implicated in cancer, Alzheimer's, and other growing plagues. Lori David is an environmental activist. Her first film, starring Al Gore, was the Academy Award-winning An Inconvenient Truth. I already said that. Lori David is an environmental activist. In addition to her films, An Inconvenient Truth and Fed Up, she's also the author of the best-selling Stop Global Warming and The Family Dinner. Fed Up was co-produced with Katie Couric. David's co-author on the companion cookbook, The Family Cooks, is Kirsten Uhrenrold. I spoke with Lori David in June. Well, Lori David, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
You produced the influential movie An Inconvenient Truth, and now you've turned your attention to the obesity epidemic. Big difference between climate change and obesity, or is there? Why did you decide to tackle the obesity epidemic?
Well, first of all, I think Fed Up is, when I think about what the movie's about, I think it's about the food we're eating and what it's doing to us, whether you're thin or fat or anything. And I think both issues are these, you know, huge issues that really need to be presented in a way that everybody can understand them. And I think, obviously, with An Inconvenient Truth and global warming, the solutions really are we need countries to come together and cooperate and work together to solve that problem. But with this problem, it's also a huge conundrum. But, you know, the solution's really in our own kitchens. And I think there's something so powerful about knowing that when people go see the film, they can leave that day knowing five things at least that they're going to do differently, and that they can solve some of this problem by just going into their kitchen and cooking food themselves. So I find that really powerful and very exciting.
Cooking at home. I heard Mark Bittman speak a couple of weeks ago at a conference, and he said it is dropped drastically. Very few people still cook at home, although to me that seems incredible because I much prefer my own home-cooked meals. What's happened to cooking at home?
Well, I think, you know, we're all the victims of 30, 40 years of marketing and advertising telling us that cooking is hard, it takes too long, we don't want to be in the kitchen, we're no good at it. And I think, you know, it's paid its toll. And I think, of course, we have two parents working and women in the workforce at record numbers. You know, all these things have contributed to it. But the truth is, like, my motto is cook or be cooked. And that's what I really think it's coming down to, the fact that half of all our meals are either takeout or they're being made by strangers. Like, think about that. This is the most intimate, the most important thing we can really do is feed ourselves, feed our loved ones, and we're outsourcing this job to strangers whose main concern is not the health of your family. Their main concern is that you buy their products. So how do they do this? They make them super salty, they add lots of sugar, so you get addicted to them, and you want them over and over again, and your palate kind of gets corrupted. And next thing you know, everybody's, you know, eating store-bought food or restaurant food or fast food, and, you know, we're not cooking ourselves. But not to go on a whole tirade about this, but I would just say that the process itself of being in your kitchen, lighting a candle, turning some music on, engaging your kids a little bit and cooking food yourself is fantastic. It's fun. It's loving. And it's, you know, it's an opportunity to slow down your day. It's an opportunity to put down the cell phone and the computer and really focus on what you're doing. And, you know, we're missing out on a lot by not cooking anymore. Not just, you know, we're hurting our health, but we're also missing out on one of the joys the day brings us.
One of the things I love so much about this cookbook, The Family Cooks, is you actually make this process pretty easy. What are some of the ways in which your wonderful recipe maker, Kirsten Ehrenhold, some of the ways that she has made it easier for families to cook at home?
She's extraordinary. She is from Denmark. And, you know, the Danes are supposed to be the happiest people on the planet, FYI, and it's probably because they're all cooking so much. So she's from Denmark. She grew up on a fruit farm, and she learned how to cook from her mom and her grandma. So she is a family cook. And I love cookbooks, and there aren't that many of them out there that are really geared towards family food. I don't want to cook for my family every night from a restaurant book. You know, that's restaurant food. So the book is filled with family food, which means that it's simple. There's not a lot of ingredients, and it doesn't take too long to make it. And that's what's so great about these recipes. And, of course, she talks you through each and every one of them and how to do it. And just by reading her little intros, you're like, oh, my gosh, this is so inspiring. And I think the book is really going to help people. Now, I consider myself an average cook, and she comes up with the recipes, and if I can cook them, I know anyone can. And the other goal behind the cookbook was for college kids, because I have two daughters who are in college now. And I am so grateful. The one thing I did right, thank God, as a mother, was that they know how to cook themselves. And, of course, when they got to college, which is one of the worst food environments you can be in, they can't eat that food. They're too used to good, real food. See, the same thing happens on the other side when your palate's used to it. So they're taking this cookbook with them to college, and my one daughter's now in an apartment with a girlfriend, and they're cooking every night and taking Instagram pictures of it, so I know that they're cooking, and I'm really proud of that.
And what did you do as a mother that got them interested in cooking?
We just insisted on family dinner every night. You know, and that's the other thing. It's like we have to send our kids off with these skills, because if we don't send them off with these skills, there's no way for them to stay healthy. And I think because, to your earlier point, the fact that fewer and fewer parents are cooking, which means that fewer and fewer kids are going to be cooking. So we have to reverse this trend. And in my house, we had dinner every night, Monday through Friday. Everybody sat down at the table. And now my kids expect that. And as a result of that, I mean, there's so many benefits from family dinner, by the way. Like, the more meals you have together as a family, the more your benefits accrue. So it's there's so much research on this. It's incredible. But they drink water with food. They crave water with food. That's a gift that you give your kids, right? And how do they learn that? They learn that because that's what you serve, water with food, water with food. And they eat all kinds of great things. And one of the ideas behind the Family Cooks was to try to start getting your kids engaged in the process, because a lot of people talk about picky eaters, which I think is a word that should be banned, by the way, because I think the second your child hears that word, they become that. And I think also that, you know, it's our job to keep offering the food over and over again for kids to taste them. They're supposed to say yuck the first time, and they could say it the fourth time. You know, it could take anywhere from, you know, 10 to 12 to 15 times of tasting something to have your palate accept it. And I think that we get frustrated and we stop offering it. We say, oh, our kids don't eat that. But they will eat it if you keep trying it. And also, if you engage them in the process of cooking, no matter how small the task, they will get engaged in a different way, and they will eat better at the table. And I've seen that in my own household. You know, even if you have kids just ripping up herbs, even if you have them just stirring something for you, or you make them the official taste tester, you know, there's so much pride associated with that. I mean, I'm the child who gets to say more salt, more lemon, more pepper. So the book is filled with little tips like that, and there's some recipes that they're so simple that kids can make themselves, and then you can assign them that task every week. That's another really fun thing that I think is goes to making food yourself, which is salad dressing, okay? If you buy salad dressing in the store, you are buying something that is loaded with sugar. You would never put that sugar in your salad dressing if you made it at home. And by the way, salad dressing is like three ingredients, a basic one, right? And if you look at the ingredients in the store on a salad dressing, it's like 30 ingredients. Like, what is all this stuff? So make your own house dressing, and we have lots of recipes for it in the cookbook. And then that becomes your family's house dressing, and every Sunday you assign someone to make that, and you have it. It's good in your refrigerator for a week, and then there's all this pride attached to it because it's your family's dressing.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with film producer Lori David about her latest documentary, Fed Up, and also about the companion cookbook, The Family Cooks. Talking about sugar and commercial salad dressing, you write in The Family Cooks, and you also make this point in your wonderful movie, Fed Up, that commercial food is booby-trapped. What do you mean by that?
Okay, well, I mean exactly that. It is booby-trapped. So there is, you know, when you're having donuts or you're having ice cream for dessert, you know that you're eating sugar, right? But you don't necessarily know you're having tons of sugar when you buy spaghetti sauce or healthy granola bars. Or let's take yogurt, right, which is marketed in this country as a healthy breakfast. And let me tell you something, that is a dessert. These fruit yogurts, you will be shocked when you look at the label and you start looking at how much sugar is in these things. So the food is booby-trapped. 80% of the 600,000 items in a supermarket have added sugar in them. I mean, that's really shocking. And the thing about it is, too, you can't just look at the label and see sugar, because they don't just list it as sugar. There's 56 names for sugar. So an ingredient label could say sugar, it could say agave, it could say dextrose, it could say, maltose, all these other names for sugar, and we have a whole list of them in the cookbook. And once you start to see this stuff, you'll never go backwards again. I really think so. I think, you know, just being aware of it will make a huge difference. And in Fed Up, we have some fantastic graphics and animations, and we go into this issue pretty deeply. And I just don't think you'll leave the theater the same. And thank goodness, because you know, to go into these supermarkets today, you have to be your own advocate and an advocate for your child. It's outrageous what's happening in supermarkets. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed this, but in the old days, Michael Pollan used to tell us, you know, you can shop the perimeter of the supermarket. That's how you get through that experience. Well, you can't even do that anymore, because there are chip displays everywhere. There's candy displays everywhere. It's down every aisle. The dairy aisle, the whole center of the dairy aisle, is now filled with holiday chocolate, whatever the holiday happens to be. And by the way, there's one every month. And it's all at the checkouts. I mean, it's terrible. And, of course, a lot of these companies pay slotting fees, which
slotting?
Means they pay a certain amount of money to the supermarket to get their product at the eye level of your child. So all those sugary cereals that are so heavily advertised to kids, they're at the 4 feet level so that when you're walking down that aisle, your kids see those cartoon characters that they love, and they see those bright colors, and next thing you know, those boxes are in your shopping cart. But I have to say something else about breakfast. So breakfast, you know, if you think about what the default breakfast in America is, it's generally a bowl of sugary cereal and a big glass of orange juice. And orange juice, ounce for ounce, has as much sugar in it as Coke.
Wow.
So we're sending kids out in the morning, and ourselves, by the way, already probably over the maximum they should be having for sugar. And once you start eating the stuff, it craves more of it. So now we're spending the day seeking sugar, craving sugar.
I can actually attest to that, because since seeing your movie and you talk about life-changing, I mean, I pride myself on eating organic and being very careful about my diet, but it did change the way I eat, and I'm eating far less sugar. Instead of one little sweet a day, it's like once a week. And I have found that I'm not anywhere near as hungry. I mean, I used to just battle constant
amazing?
Hunger. Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? I never thought there'd be something that would curb my appetite like this, right? But I took the Fed Up Challenge, which was to get off sugar for 10 days. I slept better, I had more energy, and I wasn't constantly thinking about food. It was a really strange thing, and you obviously had the same experience.
Yeah, and so now tell us a little bit about this mechanism, because I think, you know, people just think, well, okay, sugar's bad for you because it has calories, and so if I kind of balance my calories, you know, I can have the sugar that I want. But it's really a lot more complicated than that.
It is, and it's not. This isn't really a calorie issue. It's you know, if you're just eating real food and you're making it yourself, you're not going to even have to think about calories. Right, because you're just going to eat until you're full, and you're going to be eating healthy food. It's when you're eating all these processed foods and all these pre-packaged foods that you're getting just a toxic level of sugar. And the thing is, it's not about what you're putting in your tea or your coffee. It's really about the fact that we're having it with every meal, and we don't even know we're eating it. And there is a safe threshold, and there's an unsafe threshold. So think of here are some numbers directly out of Fed Up. So if you have, as an adult, 6 to 7 for a woman and 7 to 8 for a man, teaspoons a day, that's a safe threshold. That's not like by the way, you don't need any sugar, okay? It's not like you need a certain amount of sugar per day. But that's a safe threshold in your body. But the average person is having 22 teaspoons a day and up.
That's huge. And, you know, you mentioned you don't need sugar. We know if we read labels, and I do, we have the listing of, you know, minimum daily requirement, but sugar doesn't have any. And you make a point in the film, Laurie Deva, in Fed Up, and, you know, you certainly talk about this issue in the cookbook, The Family Cooks, that, you know, corporate America has been fighting, putting in the how many, you know, they have how many grams of sugar, which I think a lot of us don't even understand because we don't know how many grams makes a teaspoon. But they've been fighting regulation. Talk about that fight.
So, first of all, 4 grams equals 1 teaspoon. And how clever. Listen, I'm a cook. I cook all the time. I don't know what a gram is, right? And why do they keep that on the label, measured in grams? So you won't know how much it actually is. So that's like one of the little things that absolutely needs to change. But I think that it's one of the more shocking moments in the movie. And I can tell you, you know, if you think you know a lot about food, you're going to learn something in this film. And that was my experience, too, as one of the producers with Katie Kirk, that we thought we knew a lot about food before we started. And believe me, we have learned so much. But it is one of the shocking moments that we show the labels, and nobody has really noticed this over the years, that there's a daily requirement for everything except sugar, and next to the word sugar is nothing. And it's really extraordinary. And why is that? Well, the sugar lobby has fought it. The processed food industry has fought it and won. And this isn't, you know, you would think that the government would regulate this, but they obviously haven't succeeded in doing it. And what it does is, if you were to look at one package and you saw the daily nutrition requirement for the day, that package would probably say 200% or 150%. So that's why, you know, the one package of food, because there is no daily required amount for sugar. You don't need to eat it. So I think that's one of the big reasons politically why they've kept that off there, and that's another thing that has to change. And I think, you know, these are all eye openers, and I hope that when people, I hope the movie really changes the way people shop, and I think it will. And then if it changes the way you shop, guess what's going to happen? It's going to push up against the manufacturers and the producers, and they're going to have to change. They're going to have to change.
I wonder if you can produce industrial commercial food in a healthy way.
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you that what they're doing right now is going to bury this country in healthcare costs. I can tell you that we have 1 in 3 kids in America who are overweight or obese, and we are heading to an extraordinary amount of type 2 diabetes in children. Like, this is unacceptable. This is the first generation of kids that are going to lead a shorter lifespan than their parents. This is not okay. You know, this is like an attack on our children.
Exactly.
And we got to get pissed off. We have to get fed up. And if it means not buying these products and cooking the stuff yourself, then do it and enjoy doing it. And here's a cookbook with great, fun, easy recipes to get you started.
And that cookbook is called The Family Cooks, 100-plus recipes to get your family craving food that's simple, tasty, and incredibly good for you. Lori David, you tell in the film Fed Up, you tell the stories of 3 kids who struggle with obesity. And we have to say, these are heartbreaking stories, because these kids are doing everything they can to lose weight, and they're not succeeding. Tell us about these kids.
Yeah, well, the movie is wrapped around the kids' struggle with trying to lose weight, and like we all struggle. And one of the heartbreaking things about it is that their parents and they think they're doing the right things. They, you know, people believe what labels say. If it says healthy or extra fiber or low fat, people believe that. And they can't understand why they're not losing the weight. And you have to also remember, the mantra of this country for the last 30 years has been exercise, right? I mean, we can, you know, it's just about working it off. Well, you cannot, we're never going to be able to exercise our way out of this problem, because there's not enough hours in the day and nobody can do it. So if you drink, you know, one soda, that's an hour and 15 minutes of biking. You know, I mean, there's just not enough hours in the day to work off what we're consuming. So that's one of the heartbreaks of the story, but I think it's very relatable to everybody. And what we did was, Stephanie Sotig, who's the director of the movie, fantastic director, she gave flip cameras to these kids. She found, it took them about 9 months to find families willing to, you know, share. And it took so much courage for these families to share their stories and to kind of to let you, you know, really see inside what they were going through. But these kids had these little flip cameras that they would record in their rooms. They would talk directly to. So you really got, you didn't have boom, sound booms in people's faces and cameras. You had these kids talking directly to these little flip cameras in the privacy of their bedrooms. And they would send them to us every 2 weeks. So I think we got some extraordinary footage as a result of that.
You certainly did. You know, these are not wealthy families. I think they're pretty average for middle class, lower middle class, and even poor families. What about the issue of cost? Can poor families eat well and healthy?
Yes, they can. And again, I think this is another myth that's been propagated by the food industry to say that, oh, that kind of food is more expensive, you know, buy our product. And they market things, you know, family values, and they use that to to get people to buy these products. But there's a slide in the movie, a graphic, where we show what a family for four, what it would cost to have a homemade chicken dinner with sweet potatoes, and what it would cost for a similar kind of meal at a fried chicken place. And guess which one came out cheaper? Hello, it was the homemade meal. And you can, you know, you'll have leftovers for the next day or two. And by the way, a pot of soup with lentils in it doesn't cost that much money, and you can eat that for 3 days. I think the big issue in terms of the bigger issue is in terms of availability, that there are neighborhoods and areas in this country that can't have no access to fresh food. And that's a big problem, and I hope that's a problem that gets solved. I know a lot of people are working on that issue, the issue of food deserts.
You know, I wanted to ask you about the sugar, because you say there's a safe level. But in the film, you also mentioned in your book, The Family Cooks, Dr. Robert Lustig, and I've watched his, you know, hour and a half long video on sugar. He makes me afraid to eat any sugar at all.
How much do we love Dr. Lustig? he's so great. I mean, this doctor is on the cutting edge of everything. He tells the truth. He says it like it is. He's not beholden to any industry interests. I think he is phenomenal. He's got a great book out called Fat Chance.
Right. You say it is okay, though, that we can occasionally have...
Yes, of course. I mean, the thing is, put it back in its place. If, you know, if you have dessert, say, on the weekends, or you have, you know, a treat, or you have something sweet, there's nothing wrong with that. What's wrong is that we are eating this day and night every day, and we're not aware of it, and we're addicted to it, so we're eating even more. So, I mean, it's not about, you know, never having a dessert or never having something sweet. But it's about, you know, cooking food ourselves and rejecting the enormous amounts of food industry products that are just steeped in sugar. I should make the point of, like, why is the sugar in so much sugar in the food in the first place? And I think the movie does a great job of talking about this. And it's shocking because to this day, if you walk into any store, you will see lines and rows of low-fat, non-fat options of food. And I ate a lot of that stuff myself. I mean, I used to eat, you know, low-fat this, non-fat that, thinking that I was eating something healthy. But the Robert Lustig's point, and he's so brilliant and fed up on this point, is that he says that when they took the fat out, the food tasted terrible. So what did they do? They poured in the sugar.
Right. And I just have to tell our listeners, you know, one recipe, which is kind of, I think, exemplary of this. I have a granddaughter who, you know, thinks she doesn't like green vegetables. So I'm going to try this with her. She loves smoothies. Mm-hmm. You have a date with chocolate breakfast shake. It has milk, a banana, unsweetened cocoa powder, 4 dates, and some nut butter, as well as a handful of spinach. And you say the taste of the spinach disappears and all that's left.
It does. But you know what? I am telling you, if you know, dates are incredibly sweet. They're really sweet. And they're naturally sweet, right? So it's okay if you know, eat fruit, but don't drink fruit juice. That's another Lustig point. Yeah, I mean, I think with kids and vegetables that there's a lot of stuff going on. One thing is to not talk about this stuff at the table so much. You know, we tend to spend too much time talking about what we're eating, and I think that turns kids off sometimes, or they're a little intractable. And enjoy the food yourself, too. And just, you know, instead of everybody cleans the plate, remember that in the old days, it should just be that everyone tastes everything. And that's a rule that I had in my house, and it makes a big difference. And also it shows respect for the fact that it took time to prepare this and shop and get everything done. So everyone tastes everything. And if you keep offering it and you're enjoying it yourself, your kids are going to eventually get there.
And it makes it much easier in this wonderful book, The Family Cooks. And I can attest to it. It's easy, and the recipes are delicious. 100-plus recipes to get your family craving food that's simple, tasty, and incredibly good for you. Lori David, I just love the book and the film, and I want to tell our listeners about the Fed Up Challenge.
Well, the Fed Up Challenge is to, and this comes up at the end of the movie, I think somewhere like 40,000 people around the country have taken it. It's on the Fed Up Movie website, and it's basically to get off added sugar for 10 days. Katie Couric did it, and believe me, it was challenging for her in the beginning, for sure. But a lot of people are doing it, and I think it's really the point of it is to, first of all, take a look and try to figure out what you're consuming in a day. I think that alone, if you just did that, it would be an eye opener. So, and then to try to get off the added sugar for 10 days. And every single person that has done this has said they feel better, they have more energy, they sleep better. I mean, the list goes on and on. So I highly encourage everybody to take the Fed Up Challenge. And there's a great, I just want to mention one great recipe in the cookbook I think everybody should try too, which is this cauliflower popcorn. And, you know, when you're craving something sweet or delicious, this recipe to me proves that, the you know, real food can have these kinds of flavors and intensities that you'll love. And this is all you do is really toss the cauliflower, you cut it up small, and you toss it with olive oil and salt, and you roast it. I am telling you, when you put this on top of the stove, it won't even make it to the dinner table, because every time someone walks by, they're going to grab some and eat it. And it's just as addictive, you know, as bad stuff. So you might as well be eating the good things. And if your kids don't like vegetables, try cauliflower popcorn. I promise you, they are going to love it. It's so good.
Oh, that's great. Well, thanks again, Lori David, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lori David is the co-producer of Fed Up and the co-author of The Family Cooks. You can find recipes from the book at writersvoice.net. Next up, Nina Plank talks about real food. Don't go away.
Oh, all together, singing in the kitchen. All together, singing in the kitchen. All together, singing in the kitchen. Together with the pots and the pans. Oh, Narissa and Katrina are singing in the kitchen.
Narissa and Katrina are singing in the kitchen. Narissa and Katrina are singing in the kitchen.
Together with the pots and the pans. So Amelia and her mama are singing in the kitchen.
Amelia and mama are singing in the kitchen. Amelia and mama are singing in the kitchen.
Together with the pots and the pans. Oh, Grammy and Granddaddy singing in the kitchen. Grammy and Granddaddy singing in the kitchen. Grammy and Granddaddy singing in the kitchen.
Together with the pots and the pans.
Oh,
all together singing in the kitchen.
All together singing in the kitchen.
All together singing in the kitchen.
Together with the pots and the pans.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We first interviewed Nina Plank in 2006 about her book, Real Food, What to Eat and Why. Now she's out with the Real Food Cookbook, a mouthwatering collection of recipes for traditional dishes for modern cooks. Plank has been called the patron saint of farmers markets. She helped start the Union Square Green Market in New York City and also the first farmers market in London. She says eaters need to turn away from food fads and turn toward eating like our forebears did. Grass-fed meat and dairy, locally caught fish, whole grains, and local organic fruits and vegetables. Plank's new cookbook points the way with recipes for drinks like kombucha, soup stocks, main dishes like ossobuco and quinoa with roasted veggies, pizza dough, and desserts like peach melba. We spoke to Nina Plank in June. Well, Nina Plank, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
As we were just talking, you mentioned that you've just come back from a farmer's market. Which one was it?
Our local farmer's market is the Union Square Green Market. We don't live far away. And for me, it's the center of Greenwich Village and the best part of the week.
And I know it very, very well. In fact, I was just there a couple of days ago. Now, you had something to do with the development of the Green Market, that one and other ones in New York City. Is that right?
That's right. In 2003, I was the executive director of all the New York City Green Markets. There were about 54 then. I'm not sure how many there are now. I had a short tenure. but not an unhappy one. And I have a long-standing relationship with my own farmers markets, which I created in London, England, in 1999. And we celebrated our 15th anniversary just the other day on June 6th.
That's amazing. And you tell that story in this book, The Real Food Cookbook, Traditional Dishes for Modern Cooks. You tell that story. In fact, it was the first, is that right, first farmers market in London?
Yes, in modern times, I hasten to add, there were markets with farmers and other food producers selling local and regional produce in London since Roman times, but I introduced the first American-style farmers market on June 6, 1999, in London, and by that I mean that we have a producer-only rule. You must be a producer to sell your food, and a regional produce rule. The food comes from within 100 miles of the M25, which is the ring road that surrounds the big town of London.
And you write in this book that you saw at that farmer's market some amazing produce that you'd never seen before. And we don't mean strange and exotic. We just mean traditional and heritage.
It was beautiful. When I opened my first market, about half of my producers on the first day of 16 producers, about half were selling fruit and vegetables and half were not. And I describe that in the negative because at the farmers markets I grew up in as a child in Virginia, most of the farmers were selling produce and that was the strong association with local food. Whereas in London when I opened my first markets, the culture, the industry, the agriculture, the culture, the food culture at large had not yet lost small producers of meat, fish, game, dairy, raw milk cheeses, beautiful clotted creams. And they had not only had they not yet lost these producers, they had not yet lost the taste for eating all these foods. And so my first markets were really like small all-purpose supermarkets or grocers. And that is what tempted me to eat all those foods.
And I remember from our first interview a long time ago about your book, Real Food, What to Eat and Why, that when you began eating these kinds of foods, pasture-raised meats and dairy straight from the farm, that you actually lost, like, I think, am I right, 30 pounds without any problem at all?
All told, over the course of my reformed omnivory, I did lose 30 pounds. At the time of the markets, I was a low-fat vegetarian. I was dabbling with eating fish. And by the time I became a fully reformed, conscious omnivore, it took a while. The total journey was about 15 years. These are not overnight sensations, nor are they single-bullet miracle diets. From a low-fat monivore vegetarian to a reformed, conscious omnivore, I lost 30 pounds.
That's amazing. And you say that along the way you made a lot of mistakes, and that's one of the reasons why you wanted to introduce this book, to bring this book to readers, to correct some of those mistakes. What were some of the mistakes you made that you correct now in the Real Food Cookbook?
Well, I just had to experiment with everything. My mother taught me how to cook vegetables, but otherwise I didn't really learn to cook from anyone. So I've learned to cook from cookbooks and by experiments. So the Real Food Cookbook represents the real food primer that I wish I'd had when I was a vegetarian facing all these beautiful foods at my farmers markets. I just didn't know how to cook meatloaf or steak or lamb or spaghetti bolognese. I was pretty handy with vegetables, but I also wanted to learn what fats go with what and how to treat them and how to buy them. And I assembled all this information myself over many years. And what sort of mistakes? When I discovered coconut oil, for example, which is not the nutritional evil it's made out to be, but is, in fact, a traditional fat with a perfectly healthy place in the diet, especially tropical diets. I put coconut oil on everything. And I soon discovered that it tastes great when you roast little cubes of sweet potatoes, or it's great in a soup with chicken broth and ginger. It's not so tasty for sautéing red bell peppers. So I was my overenthusiasm for discovering traditional foods had to be corrected in culinary terms.
Oh, that's interesting.
And if I'd grown up in an Italian kitchen, I probably never would have put coconut oil on a red pepper. But you live and learn, and this book is the fruit of my efforts to learn how to cook all these dishes and to teach people to cook them, and also to cook for my family, because I have a husband and three young children, and that is a very different kitchen than the kitchen of a single childless person.
And what do you mean by that? How is it so different?
Well, one reason is that they just eat all day long, all the week long, all four of them. And the single girl meals I might have eaten, like my favorite broccoli dish for a simple supper with just a piece of salmon, are not necessarily going to satisfy this crew. So I've had to add to my repertoire, add to the diversity of the menus, serve five palates, and I do use the word serve consciously. I do not feel like a waitress. I mean serve as in service at the highest level, as in you lead people by serving them. So I have more respect for taste and more respect for appetites and more respect for diversity, and my own little food habits have had to recede in the face of this service.
Mm. And there are some wonderful recipes, many wonderful recipes in here. But you start out with what I thought might be a curious choice, although I loved it because I actually make my own kombucha. But you start out with drinks and with fermented drinks first. First of all, tell us what kombucha is and why is it so good, and do your kids drink it too?
Our children do drink it, and they love it. And when Rose was about 1.5, she used to call it her cocktail. Kombucha is a traditional fermented soft drink. Its base is something like a tea, and it is really a living colony of microorganisms. So it's full of B vitamins and probiotics. It's a raw food. Its origins are not entirely clear, but it's certainly on the real food underground all over the world now. And you can make it yourself, as you know, from a little store-bought kombucha plus a starter, which is called a baby, which you'll get from someone else who's making kombucha. It's astringent. It's tangy. It can be flavored with fruits and other things. It's a little bit fizzy. My homemade one was never quite so fizzy as the store-bought ones. And it's quite a tasty drink, an alternative to milk or water, and certainly an alternative to any sort of sugary soft drink.
Yeah, but it does have a lot of sugar in it. What happens to that sugar?
The little microorganisms eat it up. So after the fermentation process, it is akin to taking grape juice and turning it into wine. There's not a lot of carbohydrate left.
Okay. You also have a recipe for fermented ginger ale. Tell us about that one.
Well, I owe this recipe to my friend Emily Duff, who is a real food chef and home cook and mother, and I asked her to help me with the drink section because many of my readers of Real Food and Real Food for Mother and Baby are much bigger homesteaders than I am. And they make more of their own foods at home than I do. And I wanted the book to be a comprehensive cookbook for aspiring real foodists. And Emily is one of those. So she showed us a fermented ginger ale, which is delicious. And ginger is one of my top 10 flavors in the whole world of flavors. So I couldn't resist.
It sounds great, and I want to make that one. And we're talking with Nina Plank. Her new book is The Real Food Cookbook, Traditional Dishes for Modern Cooks. You have a fair amount of meat in here, and, you know, looking at folks like Bill Clinton, for example, who's become a vegan, I know that there's a lot of controversy over eating meat. So I wonder if you could take the bull by the horn, so to speak, and tell us a little bit about why you do eat meat and what are your thoughts on how that can be a healthy choice.
Sure. It's certainly a very big and important issue with lots of lots of angles. I eat meat because I thrive on it, and I serve meat to my children because they're young and growing. And I believe that the omnivore has the best chance of a solid foundation. I don't think a vegan diet is suitable for young children and mothers and fathers, or rather would-be mothers and fathers. The human is not an herbivore. The human is definitely an omnivore. And if you look at a vegan diet closely, you see that a number of nutrients are missing, and most vegans are supplementing those in some way with synthetic supplements. So I don't think it's a sustainable diet. I believe Bill Clinton is now under the advice of another nutritionist and doctor, by the way, and that he's eating protein again from animal sources. I'm not sure. A second concern I have with vegan diets is the over-reliance on soy protein, which is often industrial soy protein, which is not a very high-quality food and has a lot of plant estrogens in it, which turn into endocrine disruptors for children, men, and women. And a third concern I have is that vegan diets are not really sustainable over the long term. So a person who's on a junk food or a fast food diet who starts eating more plants may well feel better, but there are long-term nutritional consequences for all our choices. For example, we fed people margarine for about 30 years, advising them that butter would give them heart disease and margarine was good for them. But this turns out to be filled with trans fats, which caused heart disease. For example, we vilified cholesterol, and so people stopped eating fresh eggs and red meat and butter and shrimp and things naturally containing fresh cholesterol. But taking the egg yolks, for example, out of the diet of senior citizens resulted in macular degeneration. So it turns out there are a number of nutrients in yolks which are quite important. So I'm concerned about the short-termism of a vegan diet or any kind of food replacement, really. It seems to me that our best, our most stable diet is one that's truly diverse, and a diet of plants is not truly diverse. All that said, I applaud those who want to eat better meat every time they do eat meat, and if that means eating less meat and higher quality meat that you spend more on, then I think that sounds good. There are no pure vegan societies in the world. Human societies that are traditional over many generations, there are religious groups, there are people who are vegan for fasting purposes, but you don't find a culture where the humans are subsisting on plants and only plants over multiple generations. There are a number of fertility issues, among other things.
Fertility?
Yes, it turns out that it's nearly impossible for an omnivore like a human to create and then feed and nourish through adulthood a child purely on plants. There are omega-3 fats, which are available only in animal foods. Even though the body can convert some from plants to animal foods, that conversion is very slow and uncertain. There's vitamin B12, which is not found in any plant sources. And then there's the question of the quality of the protein. The body will do its very best with the protein it gives you, but the highest quality protein for the purposes of human nutrition is a whole protein, and that does come from animal sources. Now, that said, I think there are very healthy vegetarians who eat eggs and butter. I think it can be done. I wouldn't choose to, but I think it can be done. So we must make a distinction between a strict vegan diet and a vegetarian diet.
I want to go back to the eggs thing because I was actually thinking about this the other day. I've decided to cut way down on my sugar intake, as well as even grains, except completely whole grain or sourdough, just because I want to, you know, get rid of the sugar in my diet or minimize it. So I've been eating more protein, and I've been eating eggs more than I used to. And as you know, you just said that for older people, it's good for preventing macular degeneration. What about the cholesterol issue?
Well, cholesterol is a very interesting nutrient. Let's make some distinctions right from the beginning. Fresh or natural cholesterol is present in whole foods. So it is not some sort of poison that's floating around in our bodies, and it's present in our bodies. It is part of our metabolic life. Cholesterol, for example, the cholesterol known as LDL, which is low density, is a repair molecule. It goes to the scene of damaged tissues. So you could say that a high level of LDL in a person is a sign that the cholesterol molecule LDL is working overtime to repair arteries. This contrasts quite a bit with what has been suggested since the days of Eisenhower, when saturated fat and cholesterol were first demonized. The cholesterol hypothesis about heart disease, which says when you eat saturated fat or cholesterol, then your cholesterol levels rise in an unhealthy way and then you get heart disease, has been discredited by a number of serious researchers, and I commend you to an organization called THINCS, THINCS, thinks.org, a group of international scientists who have looked at the cholesterol hypothesis. A heart doctor named Kilmer McCulley has also looked at it. Here's the way I think about cholesterol. Consumed fresh in whole foods, it doesn't raise my blood cholesterol in unhealthy ways, and it serves a number of purposes in the body. For example, we manufacture vitamin D from sunlight in the presence of cholesterol in the body. For example, cholesterol is a precursor to the sex hormones. I've mentioned LDL as a repair molecule. And on HDL, the current conventional science says the higher the better. And we know that when you eat fresh, whole, you know, untampered with saturated fats, your HDL rises. So I eat egg yolks, I eat butter, I eat all saturated fats with impunity, but I eat to my appetite and I eat a balanced diet. Also, cholesterol is highly hereditary. So I sat with someone recently who has stopped eating all animal foods for fear of cholesterol, and she said, ultra-high cholesterol runs in my family. And there are people likewise who just can't raise their cholesterol no matter what they eat. So we don't mean to look to individuals. Of course, we need to look at population studies, but bear in mind that your genetics has a great effect on your metabolism. And I think that at this moment, we are overstating the importance of the indicator known as blood cholesterol.
Well, that's very interesting. And back to, again, the meat issue, of course, the other issue that is brought up is the ethical issue, the moral issue, the environmental issue. A lot of people say, you know, we need to stop eating meat because if we want to rein in climate change, it's a huge, you know, the raising of beef and other animals is a huge contributor to climate change. I wonder what's your answer to that, and maybe you could fold in some talk about grass-fed animals. Do they make a difference in this?
Sure. That's a very important question. So, number one, the ethics. I'll just say that I believe humans belong in the food chain on this earth and that humans are omnivores. So I am willing to eat other animals, and I completely respect other ethical approaches. On the ecology, I don't want to engage in a tit for tat with vegans or vegetarians, but they might wish to examine the thousands of hectares of soybean fields for all their fake milk drinks, fake meat drinks, and fake cheeses and fake yogurts and all the soybean oil Americans consume, because soybean agriculture is hugely destructive of native agriculture and ecologies in places like Brazil. The traditional fats in Brazil have nearly been completely replaced by this industrial oil known as soybeans. Meanwhile, vegetable production requires lots of water. Vegetable production conventionally, and most of it is still conventional, requires a lot of tillage, a lot of nitrogen, a lot of pesticides, and a lot of herbicides. Vegetable production requires shipping a lot of water far distances across state lines in the form of bell peppers and watermelons. So there's an environmental degradation case to be made for nearly every form of industrial agriculture, which is a depressing thought, and I hate to leave your listeners with a depressing thought. On the question of cows belching and farting, my friend Joanne Rogers has convincingly explained, I think, that the methane from cows is not really a significant contributor to global warming. So interested listeners might want to follow that one up. And then finally, how we could be raising animals. Well, certainly we can raise them fewer, smaller, and more locally, so they're not quite so fat. They're not fattened in feedlots, where we end up with a big waste product known as manure lagoons, which then poison local water systems. They could instead be raised on grass. And I do mean smaller animals, literally smaller. When you start to eat grass-fed and pastured meats, which we can define, you'll find that the animals and the cuts and the steaks and the pork chops are smaller. So what is the brilliance of the grass-fed system? Well, the brilliance is that there's a vast amount of energy up there in the sky, and it's known as the sun. And it is stored in this beautiful, lush pasture we call grass. So we make use of the energy of the sun, which the cow can magically convert into meat, fat, and I might add bones, so that we can use the bones to make broth and build our own mineral supplies. And the cows do this by walking around and eating. And they walk around and eat, and so thereby we don't have to feed them lots of grain. We don't have to grow lots of grain to feed them and use herbicides and pesticides on it. We don't have to store their manure anywhere because they are spreading it neatly around the field. And those who follow them could be pastured chickens, which means they're allowed out on pasture. Chickens are omnivores. They would like to dig through those manure patties to find fly larvae and for their protein needs, which makes beautiful eggs and good chicken meat, and reduces fly populations, thus reducing vet bills for cow farmers. And then the cows move on to the next patch of lush grass, leaving the manure on the field where it belongs, and the grass goes through a really terrific ecological cycle wherein the grass the cattle have eaten causes the roots to die back a little. The roots provide organic matter to the soil, and then when the cattle move on, the grass regrows, the roots regrow, and the soil is replenished in a sort of accordion fashion, all without tillage and runoff. So this is a terribly efficient and green system, and I think a person who wants to eat meat can feel great about eating a piece of grass-fed beef or pastured chicken or pastured pork. We say grass-fed for beef and dairy because those are true herbivores, and they do not need complete protein in their diet. They are able to manufacture it with the help of the microbes in their four stomachs. And chickens and pigs are more like us. They're true omnivores, and they do need some kind of protein in their diet.
And you have some wonderful recipes. As you were talking about grass-fed beef, I was looking at beef burgundy and osso buco, and I think I've been seeing osso buco a lot on the menu slates of New York restaurants recently, and I am inspired to try it. It's in your wonderful new cookbook, The Real Food Cookbook, Nina Plank. And this has been a fascinating discussion. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
I very much enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
Nina Plank. She's also the author of Real Food for Mother and Baby. Find recipes from The Real Food Cookbook at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.